I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. On Wednesday, President Obama sent a war authorization bill to Congress for, quote, limited use of the U.S. armed forces against the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. It does not authorize, quote, enduring ground combat operations, but it does allow the president to determine how the armed forces will be used against, quote, ISIL or associated persons or forces. If approved, the authorization would end in 3 years. I'm using quotations in my introduction because every word counts when it comes to war authorization, and this is one of Congress's most important responsibilities. Today in Radio Times, we examine this request, the reaction, some history of war powers resolutions, and the strategy of fighting ISIL or ISIS or the Islamic State. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Let me introduce them to you. Peter Spiro is the Charles R. Wiener Professor of Law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, former U.S. Department of State lawyer specializing in international and constitutional law. Peter, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty.
Also with us is Dominic Tierney. He's an associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College, a senior fellow with the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's got a forthcoming book called The Right Way to Lose a War, America in an Age of Unwinnable Conflicts. His most recent book titled How We Fight, Crusades, Quagmires, and the American Way of War. Dominic Tierney, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Great pleasure to be here.
So what is the president – let me put this to you, Peter. What is the president asking for in this authorization?
He's asking for a limited authorization here, and it's limited in a couple of ways. It's limited to the Islamic State associated forces, those who work on behalf of or alongside ISIL. So it's ISIL very loosely related to ISIL. It's limited in terms of its time, so it would be a 3-year sunset on this authorization. And then finally, it would not authorize – quote unquote, enduring offensive ground combat operations. So limited in those three important ways.
And what do you think the President, Dominic, means by enduring ground combat operations? Enduring of obviously the operational word.
Well, that's the $64,000 question here. So this is one of the key limitations in the document, enduring offensive ground combat operations. There are 225 words in the document. These are five of the most important. And I think a fair reading of this is not the Iraq war, is essentially what Obama is saying with this phrase. But note that there are the loopholes in this phrase are large enough to drive a tank through. You could do many different kinds of ground combat operations. There could be many kinds of boots on the ground that would still not be seen as necessarily enduring or necessarily offensive. So there's a wide latitude here for a president.
Let me quote something that the White House press secretary said. This is Josh Earnest about this authorization. He said, we believe it's important that there aren't overly burdensome constraints that are placed on the commander-in-chief who needs the flexibility to be able to respond to contingencies that emerge in a chaotic military conflict like this. Peter?
Yeah, so I think that's a pretty good point, and it does beg the question of why they're going to Congress for authorization in the first place. Historically, presidents, with respect to anything short of real war, that is, where the country is contemplating a massive commitment of blood and treasure, in these situations, presidents historically have not gone to Congress for authorization. They've gone it alone, and question of why Obama feels it necessary to do that here, because I think one can argue that constitutionally this is a case in which congressional authorization is just not necessary.
So why do you think he's doing it? I mean, is it for political reasons? And he has said he said for several months now, I'm going to do this. I'm going to ask for this.
I think part of it is the culture that he came out of, the legal and constitutional culture that he came out of, the fact that Dennis McDonough, his chief of staff, has a background from Capitol Hill. And he sort of thinks it's the good thing to do. I'm not sure that makes it the good thing to do. So he's trying to tread a line between protecting the institutional authorities of the presidency and then move things in a direction in which Congress gets on board, sort of everybody gets on board for something that is new, to the extent that we've got an ongoing operation here, people use the tag the Forever War. And so there is something new about this situation. At the same time, one could say that it's really just now business as usual and shouldn't necessarily require a congressional buy-in.
Well, and just picking up on that, Dominic, I mean, we have already begun an airstrike campaign in this part of the world. I think it's almost like 2,000 airstrikes so far. Mm. So it's not as if we aren't already at war with ISIL or ISIS. So this sort of adds to the layer of questions.
That's right. The campaign began about 6 months ago. And as you say, there have been nearly 2,000 airstrikes. So in one sense, it's very curious. It's like declaring war on Japan 6 months after the war began. And Obama believes that he already has authorization to use force in the form of the post-9/11 2001 congressional authorization. So he doesn't think that he needs this. This is a kind of supplementary authorization. He would claim that he already has a kind of blank check for this kind of operation. He would now like to have a second check that's a little more narrowly written along with the blank check, so he can have two checks in front of him. But he
kind of like belts and suspenders, in
right?
A way.
Perhaps right to provide kind of, I guess, backup, but not strictly required. I think to follow up on Peter's excellent analysis, Obama sort of has a dilemma. He comes out of this legal field. I think intellectually he's committed to the idea of congressional authorization. You know, and he believes in that in principle. And he also wants to get some political cover for this war by gaining congressional authorization. At the same time, he's the president and he doesn't want to bind his own hands. And a lot of the language, the murkiness of the language, comes out of that sort of tension between his theoretical commitment to congressional authorization and then the practical reality of being commander-in-chief and not wanting to sort of constrain his options.
Let me just pick up on something you said, and I'll toss this back to you, Peter. Does he have authorization from the 2001 authorization that Congress gave to President Bush? Is that the belt or the suspenders?
That's the administration's argument here, although they've never issued a detailed analysis. That the 2001 AUMF, which authorized the use of force against entities connected with the 9/11 attacks. Now, it's a little bit of a stretch here, since, of course, the Islamic State and al-Qaeda are themselves at loggerheads. So one could, I think, even make a better argument that he just has the constitutional authority to do this kind of thing. So he wouldn't need the statute to be undertaking this operation against the Islamic State. But again, I think he's uncomfortable making that sort of commander-in-chief, very broad argument, and so the AUMF is the stand-in for that.
Do you think Congress wants this authority? You're shaking your
not
head at me,
at
Peter.
All.
No.
Congress. One reason why historically presidents have not gone to Congress is that Congress doesn't want any part of these kinds of decisions, except when the country is contemplating, when the president is contemplating real war, and then Congress understands that it has a constitutional authority to step to the plate and make a decision one way or the other. This we can already see in the response to the proposal here that a lot of members of Congress are distancing themselves in one way or another. And I think there's a very good chance that nothing comes out of this.
What do you think, Dominic?
Well, I completely agree that Congress doesn't really want responsibility for this operation. I think in theory it likes to have buy-in to the decisions, but in practice, especially with a murky, probably unwinnable conflict that's going to end in a murky gray kind of resolution, it's not clear that Congress wants its fingerprints over this operation. Plus, the Congress is run by Republicans. There's partisanship. They don't really want to support the president unless they have to. At the same time, I think that they probably will produce a document, but it's not going to come anytime soon. Obama will continue fighting this war under the 2001 authorization, but I think that Congress will produce something that may deviate in some ways from this first draft that the administration created.
But does he really have authorization under that 2001 agreement? If it was to go after al-Qaeda, and as Peter said, al-Qaeda and ISIS are in a sense enemies or certainly not friends.
It's definitely
allies.
Murky. So the president claims three different authorizations. One is the 2001 anti-Al-Qaeda and associated groups authorization. So the basis there is that Islamic State is a kind of successor group to Al-Qaeda. That's murky. The second is the authorization which came before the invasion of Iraq. And so the argument here is that, well, we're doing military operations in Iraq, and it sort of can use some of the language from that. The third is simply he's commander-in-chief and can protect American interests, as he needs to do. This new suggested document explicitly ends the 2002 authorization, but it would leave the original one in place. So I think that the law is unclear, but of course, no court is going to step in, right? The Supreme Court is not going to step in. They've been traditionally loath to kind of rule on these kind of congressional presidential debates. They say it's a political question, mm-hmm. and they sort of just – they throw the football back, right? So everyone is sort of not wanting to hold the football.
Hot potato.
In some ways the constitutional question gets decided in the court of public opinion mm-hmm. in the context of war powers. And so it's sort of what flies with the people, what – flies with other constitutional actors, elites, editorialists. And frankly, today, everybody mm-hmm. seems on board with the president going it alone on whatever authority with respect to the Islamic State. So why he's forcing the question here is a little unclear.
Well, and one of the things that he says, or the White House says in this authorization, is to support our allies in the region. I mean, whether it's trying to send a message to –
don't get that, given sort of the bad odor associated with Congress these days. That's the conventional argument in favor of securing congressional authorization is that it shows that we've got the resolve to do it. I'm not sure what it adds in this particular context.
Go ahead, Dominic.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things, though I share Peter's skepticism. There's a couple things. One is that you do get a degree of political cover. So let's say that Congress passes with very significant Republican support, maybe even more Republicans than Democrats, by the way, in a few months' time, passes a document that looks something like this. Well, if the war were to deteriorate or evolve in unexpected ways, and many of our recent wars have done exactly that, and encountered difficulties, become unwinnable, well, I think Obama will be in a stronger position at the tail end of his presidency if he can turn to Republicans and say, you supported this, right? Remember John Kerry back in 2004, people said he was a flip-flop. You were before the war, before you were against it. So if the Republicans come out on record backing this campaign, it does become more difficult for them to sort of attack Obama later on. And then Obama may also believe that he's establishing a precedent for future presidents to go to Congress and ask for authorization. Presidents haven't always done that. And intellectually, he probably thinks that's an important legacy.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about the fact that earlier this week, President Obama asked Congress for war powers authorization, talking with Dominic Tierney. He's an associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College, also with Peter Spiro, professor of law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines for your questions and your comments. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Just a quick recap. On Wednesday, President Obama sent Congress a formal authorization for the use of military forces against ISIL or ISIS. It would be limited to 3 years, would not involve, quote, enduring offensive ground forces, although many questions have been raised about those that turn of phrase. Now lawmakers will be debating U.S. action against the terrorist group and the president's wartime powers. And that's what we're talking about with our guests, Dominic Tierney and Peter Spiro. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Peter, you talk about forever war, and that is a phrase that we have been hearing more and more as we think about the protracted war in Afghanistan, the protracted war in Iraq, and whether we're sort of with these terrorist threats going to be in a constant state of, if not vigilance, some degree of warfare. I mean, is that something we need to get used to?
I think so.
Looking into the future, obviously.
And I do question the the label war here, because it's not war in the sense of massing hundreds of thousands of troops and requiring resources that are going to distort the economy in some important way. It's really more like the Cold War, during which we were in a constant state of vigilance and where there were skirmishes on the margins that never enjoyed congressional authorization. And so it's just something that we need to and are getting used to, and it does require a lot of flexibility, and that's something that Congress really isn't that well equipped to dictate on a going forward basis.
Well, and how much – I mean the commander-in-chief, the president, has – from the Constitution, some pretty awesome powers when it comes to war, does he not, Dominic?
Well, he does. The founders separated out the powers, giving Congress the right to declare war, and the president was the commander-in-chief. Congress has basically given up declaring war.
Haven't done that since the Second World War, right?
Since World War II. Although it's interesting, that's part of a wider international trend where countries have stopped declaring war on each other. And that's partly because declaring war seems a very aggressive act. Notice also how we used to have departments of war. Now we have departments of defense, right? So this is part of a sort of change in norms and rules where you're not supposed to wage aggressive war. And in fact, countries don't tend to wage aggressive war. So it's sort of a good thing. But the effect of that is that Congress has lost its power to declare war as a sort of side effect. And so now you just get these kind of congressional authorizations. Sometimes the president asks for one, sometimes they don't. And it's not very consistent.
So I agreed completely with Dominic that there's really been a change in the discourse of the use of force, so that declaring war is really obsolete now in the international frame. I do think that there is some consistency in the pattern of when Congress does authorize. So Congress doesn't declare war formally anymore, but it will authorize the use of force, and it does so in all cases where we're talking about a real war. So in 1991, when President Bush the Elder went in to expel expel Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, when President Bush invaded Iraq in 2002, those got advance authorization from Congress. On the other side, when you've got some lesser uses of force, very consistent practice under which Congress does not authorize in advance. And I think one can discern a sort of constitutional norm out of that practice.
And that would be what? Panama, Kosovo?
Panama, Grenada. In 1983, Kosovo, in 1999, President Clinton, in defiance of the War Powers Resolution, continuing the bombing there. Somalia, bombing of Tripoli in 1986, the Marine deployment in Lebanon in 1982 and 83. The Libya operation in 2011 was not authorized by Congress in advance, not authorized by Congress at all.
And you're saying totally and that's legitimate. I mean, that's sort of the way it should work.
Sort of history, I think, supplies the precedents and the rules, and those have guided presidential decision making on this question. And Obama's going to Congress here is a departure from that practice.
Looking at the war in the Iraq war and the Afghanistan war, I mean, there were war authorizations, but there wasn't the same kind of declaration? No, that we had in World War II. I'm looking at you, Dominic.
No, you didn't have this grand, societal declaration of war. But of course, that partly reflects the fact that war has evolved, right? So before 1945, most of America's major wars were classic interstate wars. We fought against Spain, we fought against Germany, we fought against Japan. There's a clear battlefield. We win. They sign some sort of surrender document. We go home. That's the kind of American model of what war ought to look like. That's not what war has looked like in the last few decades, right? It tends to be these murkier civil war situations or counterterrorism operations. And to go back to the sort of endless war frame, this is not going to end anytime soon. Mm-hmm. So Congress has authorized, but it's not a societal sort of declaration.
Well, and Congress does have the power of the purse, I guess, right, Peter? So if there's something they don't like, they can defund it.
That's right. They can shut things down. Now, historically, there's always – and Vietnam was a classic example of this, a strong disincentive to leaving our troops in the field without adequate support. But with respect to something like the campaign against the Islamic State, where you're just talking bombing runs and no deployments, no significant deployments, I think Congress would feel more if they really wanted to stop things, I think there'd be fewer obstacles to their doing it, and they would do it through the power of the purse.
We have an email from Ed. Hi, Marty. I'm a bit shocked at the kind of matter-of-fact descriptions of this new war with ISIS as quote-unquote business as usual. The debate about authorizing military force is one of the most important ones that Congress can have. Please discuss the lack of geographic boundaries in this authorization and the vague term used of associated forces. We touched on that earlier, but not deep enough for Ed. You want to take that, Dominic?
Sure. So back in 1964, Lyndon Johnson gained the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. So this was the famous resolution which authorized the Vietnam War. And Johnson described it as, quote, grandma's nightshirt, because he said it covered everything.
And grandma's nightshirt. Okay.
This is one of Lyndon Johnson's yes. sort of Texas turns of
yes.
phrase. I won't try and do the Texas accent.
No, please don't. No one could do that.
In fact, if you look at that resolution, that actually only applied to Southeast Asia, right? Even this sort of famous resolution, which has gone down in history as authorizing an expansive war, only applied to Southeast Asia. This resolution has no geographical limits. The president is authorized to use force against ISIS or associated groups
right.
anywhere in the world. Now, there are a lot of legitimate questions that would be raised about this. If some group pops up in Somalia and declares themselves associated with ISIS, are they now suddenly fair game? On the other hand, I can understand why the president has been reluctant. Because you can easily imagine scenarios where the conflict expands. You know, it'd be very easy to say, oh, it should just be Iraq and Syria. What if ISIS were to move into Lebanon? What if they were to move into Jordan? We saw this horrific killing of the Jordanian recently. Is that suddenly off limits, right? So you can understand the reason that they want to have some flexibility geographically. On the other hand, at the moment, it's global. And I think what Congress is going to look at very carefully is these two questions. Should we have some geographical limits, for example, to the Middle East? And then is it okay to say ISIS and associated groups, or do we need to narrow that a little bit?
Yeah, I think
why these specific words matter so much.
Yes, and they're real. fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. The 2001 AUMF had the same, actually narrower language. Mm-hmm. And President Obama has used that to undertake operations in Somalia and Mali. And here we've got the on behalf of ISIL language, which might include sort of lone wolves who just decide that they want to support ISIL. Something like the Charlie Hebdo attack might fit under this definition. Not that we're likely to be invading Paris anytime soon. But so this I think Dominic's completely right that this raises red flags at the same time that the new nature of conflict makes it much harder to impose geographic limitations in the way that was true with respect to even something like Vietnam or even the 1991 war to expel Saddam Hussein from Kuwait.
And just picking up what you said, Dominic, which is in many ways it doesn't feel this way, but we don't have the kind of interstate wars that we mm-hmm. used to have. Mm-hmm. But we do have, it looks like, conflicts, civil wars or some
right.
kind of internal disruptions in a number of countries around
right.
the world.
Right. That is the great pattern of warfare. So what we have seen is the good news, so to speak, is a decline in your classic interstate wars, wars between countries. So great powers haven't fought each other since the Korean War 60 years ago. And in modern history, that's a long period of peace, right, the long peace. The bad news is that civil wars still exist, and in fact they dominate the landscape of conflict. So you see Ukraine, you see Gaza, you see Iraq, you see Syria, Libya. These are overwhelmingly civil wars. So it is good that countries have stopped fighting each other. The mm-hmm. problem is that the remaining conflicts on the table, these civil wars, are intractable, extremely difficult for an outside actor like the United States to resolve. And so that is the dilemma, that the world in many ways is more peaceful. We're not fighting each other as countries, but militarily it's become far more challenging in many ways for the U.S.
Is that because these countries might not be fighting each other, but they are fragile?
Right, exactly. So the real threat in many ways is not strong countries, but weak countries, right? You know, Afghanistan collapses in the 1990s into civil war, becomes the base for al-Qaeda, and that's the launch pad for 9/11. So in many ways, it's state failure that is the huge issue of the age.
It's interesting, Peter, in this request for authorization, the president puts a three-year time limit on it. So it would take it three – I mean, assuming it passed – sort of the way it's been written, would take through his presidency and also into the presidency of whoever the next president of the United States is.
Yeah, I think this is another very problematic aspect of this. I think it goes to President Obama's desire to get buy-in on a continuing basis from Congress. But imagine 3 years from now, things are still unstable. The U.S. is still – it's still in the – U.S. national security interest to undertake these operations. Who knows what Congress looks like 3 years from now? Such an authorization expires, and then is the president just supposed to stop using force, even though it's clearly it clearly serves our strategic interest, but there's some political reason? And this was the case with President Clinton's bombing of Kosovo, under which there's a war powers resolution that says you've got to stop 60 days after you start if you don't have authorization. And President Clinton just kept on going. And that's the kind of – it's setting up the same kind of scenario with this sunset in the requested authorization here.
I mean, it's such an irony. This, you know, the Iraq war was – I think the president called it a – I'm not against all wars, but I'm against stupid wars. But, right. And here we are. It's not exactly the war in Iraq, but it's the war against ISIL or ISIS, which is – in parts of Iraq.
Sure. I mean, this is one of the many ironies of this. Here you have a president, Barack Obama, who comes to power on the issue of ending the Iraq war, right? That is how he outmaneuvered Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary. That is, in many ways, how he defeated John McCain. In some ways, that's also how he beat Mitt Romney in 2012. So the ending the Iraq war is sort of the fundamental element. Without the Iraq war, I don't think there is an Obama presidency, right? And yet, here he is in another war in Iraq. And I think that he looked at the options. He's loath to get involved in Iraq. He looked at the options and believes that a limited aerial campaign is the least worst option.
And that's Dominic Tierney, who joins us along with Peter Spiro. We are talking about the fact that President Obama on Wednesday asked Congress for war authorization powers to go after ISIL or ISIS. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We have a call actually from – it looks like our phones might be down. We have a call from Dave in Hamilton. My understanding is that Obama wants to limit the use of ground troops. Doesn't the old authorization get eliminated by the new one? Won't it limit future presidents' ability to use ground troops? And we were talking about – I mean, there are several authorizations that are already sort of, I guess, in place. Can you take that one, Peter?
Well, one reason that I think this requested authorization amounts to window dressing is that this limitation of – not using enduring offensive ground combat operations is something he would never do without specific authorization in advance. So it's basically – it's just repeating the obvious here. And so even if he could argue that under the 2001 AUMF he has that power, he's not going to put that to work now, partly for the reasons that Dominic mentioned, that this is – He's been trying to get out. He came to the presidency trying to get out of all these operations, dealt a very bad hand, of course, and this is sort of threading the needle from his perspective.
And even part of the complexity, and this relates to Syria, is that by taking on ISIL or ISIS, that puts us on the same side as Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria. But perhaps, Dominic, you know, we can't think of armies sort of on a field facing each other. This is not the world we live in anymore.
Right. This is one of the ironies. Bear in mind that in 2013, Assad's forces used chemical weapons, and we came within an ace of going to war against Assad.
Yes.
It was only a last-minute deal to get rid of Assad's chemical weapons that stopped the U.S. from fighting Assad. If we'd gone ahead against Assad, we might today be fighting Assad and ISIS, which are at war with each other. What makes it a little more complicated is that, although, as I just mentioned, Assad and ISIS are technically at war, in some ways, Assad actually deliberately cultivated the rise of Islamic State. to make the opposition to his regime as extreme as possible, so that the international community would then be faced with a choice of the lesser evil or the greater evil. And in fact, Assad's strategy has, although it's a devilish strategy, has proved to be quite effective. Few people in Washington are talking about regime change anymore.
That's
in Syria.
True. That's true.
Right? The focus is on Islamic State, and Assad looks like he's going to survive.
I mean, it looks like whack-a-mole. I mean, that's the world we live in.
And remember, Obama said he would go to Congress for authorization for action against Syria in the earlier episode, and that fell totally flat. Mm-hmm. And he was really saved at the bell by the UN's coming in and brokering a deal on chemical weapons with the Assad regime. But he sort of didn't learn his lesson on that one, I think.
This is, I guess, looking ahead about what Congress's responsibility is, Peter. So the president has asked for authorization. I guess that leads to some kind of hopefully a real debate that we can have. You just rolled your eyes at me.
Well, that's in a perfect world, or maybe in the old world, we could have expected that. I think we'll see something that's a little less of appealing by way of debate. And I mean, Dominic mentioned earlier that Obama is maybe trying to set a precedent here. Well, what if Congress can't get its act together to pass anything? I think that just reinforces the historical practice under which Congress just demonstrates itself to be incompetent with respect to these smaller kinds of conflicts.
I mean, when something like this is sent, is the hope, give us some kind of authorization or direction within a couple of months or a couple of weeks? Or I mean, is there no time frame for this?
No, there isn't. In the meantime, of course, he's just going ahead and bombs are dropping.
Yeah, we're almost at a break. Looks like you want to say something.
Sure, I was going to say, I hope that there's a better debate, right? Back in 2002, before the invasion of Iraq, the debate was terrible, right? Congress did not think through the critical, critical question, which is what was going to happen after Saddam fell, right? What was the end game? How is the U.S. going to create a new stable regime? That issue was just largely ignored. There was a lot of discussion of weapons of mass destruction and mushroom clouds, and people forgot about the end game. So I hope that the debate is about that.
And that's Dominic Tierney, who joins us along with Peter Spiro. And we are talking about the fact that earlier this week, President Obama asked Congress for war powers authorization to, in a sense, fight ISIL or ISIS. We'll take a very short break, then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and we're talking about the president's request for war powers authorization, the reaction in Congress, the history of war powers resolutions, and the strategy for fighting ISIS or ISIL. And again, our guests are Peter Spiro. He's the Charles R. Wiener Professor of Law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law, also a former U.S. Department of State lawyer specializing in international and constitutional law. Also with us, Dominic Tierney. He's an associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College, a senior fellow with the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's got a forthcoming book called The Right Way to Lose a War, America in an Age of Unwinnable Conflicts, and wrote most previously How We Fight, Crusades, Quagmires, and the American Way of War. And yes, we are talking about war in this hour of Radio Times. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I want to read a quote from Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia. And he said, if money or military might would change that part of the world, this would be the Middle East, we'd be done a long time ago. Then he went on to say, in West Virginia, we understand the definition of insanity. And what he means, of course, is by doing the same thing over and over again, hoping for different results, which Dominic raises the question of how do you defeat or how do you have victory? And we still hear that language in a war against ISIL or ISIS.
Well,
or do we?
So in chess, you can end up in a situation called Zugzwang. And Zugzwang means move anguish. This is a situation in chess where basically there are no good moves and you're choosing among terrible moves, essentially. And Obama faces, in some ways, his own kind of Zugzwang here, which is that there is no great option, right? We go in big, then it's another Iraq war, right? We don't do anything, and Islamic State could push further into Iraq. The whole country could disintegrate. And so what he has chosen is, and I broadly agree with it, is that it's the least worst option, a limited use of force to basically stop the advance of ISIS and sort of break their momentum. The challenge now is to sort of think about how does this end, right? What is the strategy to overall defeat ISIS, especially if the United States is not going to send in large amounts of ground troops, which is what Obama has said. And then in addition to that, if ISIS is defeated, what comes next? Because in previous wars, we've always ignored this question of what comes next.
What are your thoughts about that?
So I think those are questions that are best answered by the president,
well,
and not by Congress. So that's one angle here. The other, the thing that the Manchin quote brings to mind is that there are various reasons to be opposed to this requested authorization. There, we may see the emergence of a right-left alliance against it. So on the left, so Manchin, a Democrat, is just against any use of force. And then on the right, they're calling this the weakling authorization. So Boehner and the Wall Street Journal are saying, why tie our hands? Why send this signal to Islamic State that we're not going to go in whole hog with this? And the two together may be enough, even though they're working from opposite ends, may be enough to defeat the requested authorization.
There's no compromise. I mean, I don't know if compromise happens.
Well, that's
anymore.
Right. Compromise. That's
the
problem.
Compromise would be that thing in the middle.
I think
right?
In the old days that if we were looking at this kind of dynamic in the 1970s or 80s, when you had a little bit more of a statesman presence on the Hill, that there would be that kind of opportunity. Now, especially as we start going into the 2016 presidential contest, there's a lot of posturing and there'll be a lot of buyout instead of buy-in.
And you know, talk about the American public. I mean, sick of war after Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, just war weary and feeling as if there's no resolution. There wasn't that peace treaty right. That was signed.
Right, exactly. I think that's exactly right. The mood is against war, especially any kind of drawn-out nation-building, boots-on-the-ground kind of operation. At the same time, I think Americans broadly support the war on terror frame still, and you would see majority support for this kind of limited mission in the Middle East. In fact, I think a poll came out today supporting Obama's request for authorization. On the other hand, I don't think Americans are very confident that this is going to achieve a victory anytime soon. So a sort of wary, tired, almost exhausted mood, supportive nevertheless of limited operations in certain situations, especially against ISIS, which is a barbaric extreme group.
Mm. I notice in this authorization, Peter, he does mention the four U.S. citizens he holds responsible for. Holds ISIS responsible for their death, James Foley, Stephen Sotloff, Abdul Rahman, Peter Kasig, and Kayla Mueller. The first three were actually beheaded. She died apparently or allegedly in some kind of an attack, but certainly was held hostage by ISIS. But the use of those names of four hostages does kind of personalize this, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think that it's a part of the explanation for why the public is broadly supportive of the operation. It's really also the only real point of engagement. You get the graphic kind of brutality of the beheadings in particular, and that's something that even as people avert their eyes from it, it's hard to ignore. Otherwise, the public's largely disengaged from this, and I don't think we'll see a broad public debate over this authorization in the way that when we have gone into real wars, there has been some pretty serious public engagement.
I mean, it's just too bad. I mean, it's actually tragic and I think a huge mistake that we can't – either Congress won't debate this stuff, the American public won't debate this stuff. I mean, there's nothing more important than going to war, whether it's a big war or a little war, and yet we don't want to talk about it.
I think that's right. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to deal with the really tough questions about Iraq and Afghanistan, right? Instead, what you're seeing is a kind of mixture of amnesia and phobia, right? Amnesia, this sort of just forget the whole thing, right? I don't want to think about it. I don't want to get involved in it. Just forget it and move on. And then phobia, I don't want to touch anything that looks at all like the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And that can also be dangerous. What we really need to do is sort of really look at the sort of the tough lessons, the real truths of the last 10 years, and try to get a sense of national renewal.
Mm. What are those truths, do you think?
Well, fight fewer wars, firstly. If you are going to go to war, make sure you have a plan to win the peace, right? And think through the long-term strategy. Be prepared for a world of civil wars, right? Rather than necessarily planning for the kind of wars that we want to fight, which I think are these older, classic kind of interstate wars. This is the world we live in, and we need to be prepared for it.
Anything you want to add to that, Peter? Then we'll get to some callers.
So I think complete non-starter to contemplate any kind of real war at this point. And with respect to these little wars, I'm not sure that it's necessarily so important that the public be engaged. I mean, this is something that really as Commander-in-Chief, the president knows should know best. And that's something that's constitutionally delegated to his power to decide. It's only when we're getting into the real thing that it's then imperative that Congress and the public be engaged, and historically that's been the case.
But what's that line between the real thing and the lesser thing?
Very good question, and this is new, this sort of continual war. But the line would be a massive commitment of troops, a high risk of casualties. So that's something we don't have with respect to the ISIL operation, and then massive commitment of funds. And that's also something that, even though it's expensive to run these operations, you're not talking real war, kind of Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Persian Gulf conflict 1 or 2, where there's at least the potential for that kind of full scale engagement.
Go ahead, Dominic. Then we will get to our callers, promise.
Yeah, I would just add, though, as a sort of caveat to that, that the small wars can become the big wars, right? Neither Iraq nor Afghanistan were originally designed to be multi-year prolonged nation-building missions.
It was supposed to be easy, wasn't it?
Exactly, right? The cakewalk, right? We go in quickly, we get rid of the bad guys, and we get out. That was the plan. Didn't work like that.
But both were authorized.
But both were authorized, exactly. Mm-hmm. Let me get Fee from Point Breeze to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Fee. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thank you so much to your guest.
Sure.
And I want to just kind of summarize everything that they said about the Congress not having as much say. And I want to go back to, and I'm not a historian, forgive me, but
that's okay,
the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, what is it that has not worked so far? And is President Obama just trying to send a message across to these hoodlums that are doing what they're doing in public, saying, listen, we still have the power to be mightier than you, whether you like it or not, and it's going to be brief, it's going to be precise, and we're going to end it in 3 years, and take this message that we're going to be united about this?
Well, Fee, let me toss that first to Dominic, see what he thinks.
I think part of the idea behind this is to send this message that the U.S. is united. Although, you know, when we look at how Congress is going to debate this in a partisan and divided way, I'm not sure that will be the message. But I'm not sure that anyone really believes that this is going to be a short, sharp military campaign. The 3-year date strikes me as largely arbitrary, and we discussed it earlier. It's not clear why 3 years. We've been fighting this for 6 months. Is it going to take 3 more years? It's not the end of the Obama administration. It takes us well into the next administration. So I think the idea is to sort of send a unified message, but I don't think anyone thinks it's going to be quick.
We have an email from Gary. Didn't Congress consistently request the president to get Congress more involved? How does this make the U.S. look globally, Peter?
I mean, yes, Congress wants to have its cake and eat it too. Here, it wants to look like it's engaged at the same time that when the ball actually gets thrown into its court, it all of a sudden looks less comfortable with the request. So it likes to be able to carp. It, as Dominic pointed out earlier, it likes to be able to pass the buck. And if things head south, then be able to say, well, we weren't on board. We weren't on board with this one. And that's the incentive for the president to secure the authorization. Although here, what this is a reason why we've got this small war, large war distinction in the history. And that is, How south could things head with respect to the Islamic State operation? Again, very low risk of casualties. And so I'm not sure that the downside risks are so great here that the president really needs to have Congress on board.
But would going south be that they were able to take over Iraq, for instance, and boot that government out of there?
Right. I think that Peter is right that Obama is absolutely loathed to turn this into a large ground combat operation. It would take an extreme situation. But an extreme situation is possible. If ISIS looked like it was going to defeat the Iraqi state and Iraq was going to collapse, if Obama was faced by the choice of seeing the disintegration of Iraq, the loss of Iraq, I think that, in fact, he would choose this loathed option of sending in U.S. large numbers of U.S. ground forces. So hopefully that scenario doesn't happen, but it's on the table. Obama has put the flag down, essentially, and said ISIS will not take over Iraq.
And sort of the line in the sand, so to speak. And that's Dominic Tierney, again, associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College. He's got a forthcoming book called The Right Way to Lose a War, America in an Age of Unwinnable Conflicts. Peter Spiro, also with us, he's the Charles R. Wiener Professor of Law at Temple University's Beasley School of Law. We are talking about important things in this hour of Radio Times, the fact that President Obama earlier this week asked Congress for war powers authorization so the U.S. Could join its allies in the region to fight ISIS or ISIL or even the Islamic State, all those used interchangeably. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me see what Diana from Conshohocken has to say. Diana, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Hi there. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm just curious what your guests would think the world would look like now had we never invaded Iraq in the first place.
Well, it's interesting to speculate. I don't know. Can we imagine that world, Dominic?
Well, it's probably a very different world. And of course, 10 years have passed, so who knows. But what I would say is that it probably would be a better world. I think we can look back, admittedly with the benefit of hindsight, and say that if we'd invaded Afghanistan and focused from the start on a serious effort to create an effective Afghan regime and put the necessary resources and time into that effort and not then got distracted by the Iraq war with its terrible costs, 4,500 Americans killed, that would have been better. On the other hand, it wouldn't have been a perfect world, right? Because Saddam Hussein would still be in charge. Who knows how the Arab Spring would have affected a Saddam era Iraq? We just don't know. So a lot of unknowns there. Probably would have been better for the United States, however.
I agree completely on that. That we'd be in a better place, although not a perfect place. On the congressional authorization question, imagine if President Bush had not secured authorization for the invasion of Iraq. After it headed south, I think we would have seen some pretty serious efforts to impeach him as having acted unconstitutionally. And so he basically protected himself politically and legally by securing authorization in advance of a major operation that then obviously did not go perfectly.
I hate to ask this at the very end of the show, but we haven't really talked about the War Powers Resolution 1973. To you, Peter, does that factor into what's going on today?
Well, the War Powers Resolution is on the books, but it really doesn't operate in any meaningful way. And in fact, it's a cautionary tale for the 3-year sunset on this legislation. It imposes a 60-day limitation on the use of force by presidents without specific authorization. And in at least two instances, the 1999 bombing of Kosovo and the 2011 operation in Libya, presidents have essentially ignored it with impunity. So as Dominic pointed out earlier, the courts don't get involved in this. And it does show the limitations of the letter of the law when it comes to the use of force.
Well, we do have to end our discussion. My thanks to the two of you for joining us today on Radio Times. A very interesting conversation. Peter Spiro, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And Dominic Tierney, thank you very much as well.
It was my pleasure.
And go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.